Leviticus begins with a series on the offerings. The name Leviticus is not the way the Hebrew has it, of course. The Hebrew doesn't give names to the Hebrew as in other ancient Semitic works, named their books by the first word, for instance, Genesis or Bereshit. But the word Leviticus comes from the Septuagint, and the idea is that this is for the work of the Levites. It's a priestly book. It's a priestly handbook, but it's not only a priestly handbook, it is that. But it begins this way, begins with the offerings, the five major regular offerings, the burnt offering, the fellowship offering, the sin offering, and the guilt offering. I've missed one. The grain offering. The grain offering, the King James calls that the meal offering, the meat offering. The Old English use of the word meat, which means food, because it had no meat in it. Funny that the only one called meat offering is the only one not with meat. We in the New Testament, in the NIV, have called that the grain offering because it was made with grain. So you have these offerings and how they're made, how often they're made, whether they could be made with different kinds of animals and whatnot. The sin offering and the guilt offering. The guilt offering is there in chapter 7. And the guilt offering, the distinction between the sin offering and the guilt offering is an old problem. They are similar, put it that way, for the time being. There are some slight differences, and details of those offerings are given. Then, after these offerings in the first 7 chapters of Leviticus, you have a natural conclusion, the ordination of Aaron and his sons. Who's going to do the offering? Aaron and his sons. They are consecrated in chapter 8, and in chapter 9, the priests begin their ministry, and in chapter 10, you have the sad and really shocking chapter of the death of Nadab and Abihu, the priests who did their work in the wrong way. And it is interesting that at the beginning of the worship in ancient Israel, you had such a strong condemnation of doing the work of the Lord in the wrong way, just as in the New Testament, you had such a strong condemnation of Ananias and Sapphira, who also were a blot in the early Christian community. But here it is, 8, 9, and 10, the ordination of the priests and the death of Nadab and Abihu, who died because they offered carelessly. Now we'll have to look into that, what it was. Some have suggested, I think quite rightly so, that it is quite probable that they were drunk. But we'll see more about that. Then comes the long section on the cleanliness. That goes from 11 through 15. 11 through 15, the laws of cleanliness. This is what in the modern Jews is called kosher. Kosher food. What is kosher food and kosher action? Now, the Old Testament has certain principles of cleanliness. The kosher rules of modern Jews are a little bit more, they're more extreme and more detailed, and hard to tell some of the reasons for some of them. The reasons why some food is clean and some unclean, this is not only for food. You have uncleannesses in houses and uncleannesses of various sicknesses. So this section in Leviticus is the most complete one. It is paralleled in the book of Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy, I think it's 15. In Deuteronomy, you have a section that parallels this, some parts of it word for word, but not nearly so extensive as it is here. Now, why does it come in Leviticus? Well, because the priests were the people who handled the questions of cleanness and uncleanness. If a person was unclean, he came to the priest. And the priest examined him, said he was unclean. And at the end of that period, he came back, the priest declared him clean. So this was another part of the priest's duty. What these uncleannesses, what they mean and theologically and what they meant practically, we'll have to take up in detail, but at least this is the section. There's not an awful lot about cleanness and uncleanness in the rest of the Old Testament. It is one of those things that is assumed, and I'm sure it happened. The Nazarite vow is mentioned many times elsewhere, uncleanness of blood, the unclean use of that blood is unclean. That's mentioned numbers of times in the Old Testament. But the detail, the rules for cleanliness are given right here in Leviticus, and mainly, not only, but mainly here. That's through 15, and then chapter 16 stands by itself. Chapter 16 is a very important chapter, and I think we'll ask you to translate that probably in its entirety. Chapter 16 is the Day of Atonement, which in modern Jewry is called Yom Kippur. Actually, in the Hebrew, it's Yom Kippurim. They use the plural. I don't know what the difference in meaning might be there, but Yom Kippurim, the Day of Atonement. And the regulations for the Day of Atonement and the meaning of the Day of Atonement is a very important thing. So chapter 16 is a key chapter in the book of Leviticus, as we all know. Connected with it, perhaps, is chapter 17, which speaks about the sanctity of blood. Chapter 16, the sanctity of blood in verse 10. You might call this part of the laws of uncleanness, but there's a little bit more to it than that, surely. And it is at least repeated that the blood is sacred, and it is said in connection with the offering, so it has a special meaning beside the laws of cleanliness, I think we may say. Key verse, of course, is in Leviticus 17:10 or 11. The life of a creature is in the blood, and I've given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life. So this is a theological principle of sacrifice here, a very important verse. Then there comes a section which is commonly called the Code of Holiness, the Holiness Code. And that goes from 18 to 26. There are some different views on that, whether it's exactly 18 to 26. I don't need to worry now. But this is called the Holiness Code. The emphasis is on holiness, that is, on morality morality, but also sanctity with regard to God and everything is complete. The Holiness Code, chapter 18 and chapter 20, cover somewhat similar things. There are laws of conduct, sexual conduct, marriage regulations, and other things. And there is a constant use here of that you shall be holy because I am holy. This is why it's called the Holiness Code. Now, that's a little bit of an oversimplification. Many times it does not say, you must be holy because I am holy, just as you must be holy because I am the Lord. Because God is God, he has a right to tell you what is holy and what is not, what is right and what is wrong. But there is often the statement, you should be holy for I am holy, which is found, remember, twice in the New Testament in Matthew. Be therefore perfect, as your Father in heaven is perfect. It's also in 1 Peter, which says, be ye holy, for I am holy, which is found in various forms in various places in the Levitic, in the Holiness Code here. So this section is usually called the Holiness Code. Now, critical people, this is a name, really, that comes from criticism. I'm not sure that it's a good name. It does... useful, it does show that there is a particular section here, Leviticus stands for it less by itself, but the critical views are that the Holiness Code is not part of the book of Leviticus. Of course, they divide it all up, just as they divide the rest of the Pentateuch and other things into various documents. So I don't have a great deal of use for the expression the Holiness Code, but this material is somewhat similar. Different questions arise in this point. You have here commands, but there's a tendency, again in critical circles, to speak of two kinds of commands. There are the imperative commands, you shall not, like the Ten Commandments. These are called apodictic. That is, they are statements thou shalt not. And that these apodictic commands are distinguished in form. Some critics particularly like to make great differences in form. They're distinguished in form from what is called casuistic legislation. Now, the casuistic legislation is case law, put it in English, case law. And it has the form, if you do such and such, then so and so. If you strike your neighbor, the penalty is. If you commit adultery, then the penalty is death. So these are case laws, and the casuistic, these are the imperative laws. The imperative law. You shall do this, you shall do this, you shall not do that, because I am the Lord. And, of course, there's a lot of discussion that revolves around these. The case laws are said to come from one, by the critics, said to come from one source, and the moral or apodictic laws are said to come from another source. So those are some of the problems we have to look into when we come to this section. I'm rather opposed to the view that we should distinguish between these. And one reason I do that is because as we look into these laws in 18 and 20, you will find that some of the same items are mentioned once in apodictic law and once in case law. Why is that? Well, there's a perfectly good reason, but they're not from different sources. So whether this is a valid distinction or not, at least it may be a useful distinction as far as form is concerned. I'm not too concerned about form. You see, the idea of Formgeschichte, the idea of form criticism, is that you have different forms and you get different authors. The trouble is one fellow can use two forms. That you have to have different authors for different forms is imaginary. And here you have what somebody at least thought was two forms for the same thing and didn't see any problem. So that they had to be different authors, I think is quite wrong, but at least this is the holiness code. Now, it takes up other things besides what I have discussed. It takes up also a section on the feasts. The feasts in chapter 23, in 23 and 25, a little hiatus in 24, might say 23 to 25, you have a section on the feasts of ancient Israel. Now, feasts, I don't know whether feasts is good, festivals. They are the worship gatherings. They were not just to have food, and they weren't just to have a good time. They were the worship gatherings of ancient Israel. And, of course, you know there were three per year, three that were required to be there at the central tabernacle, central sanctuary. And these are denoted here. First, there is the Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath. Then there is the Passover, and then the Feast of First Fruits and the Feast of Weeks, and then the Feast of Trumpets, and then the Day of Atonement and the Feast of Tabernacles. Those five feasts are celebrated by the Jews to this day. The first is of course, they celebrate the Sabbath too, but the Feast of First Fruits and then the Feast of Weeks. But the high holy days of the Jews today are in the fall. Those high holy days are the Feast of Trumpets, which they call Rosh Hashanah. Now, Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of the year, and in the Bible it's called the Feast of Trumpets when they blew trumpets at the first of the year. Actually, I believe that somewhere something happened that the Bible has the year beginning in the spring, not the fall. But the modern Jewish New Year is in the fall. Now, when that happened, I suppose that might be a good paper for somebody. If somebody could find out when that happened, why, I would give you a good grade and you'd be famous. But at least you could investigate. So the Feast of Trumpets, let me just say that the Feast of Trumpets was more useful than it seems to us. because the Feast of Trumpets was not only the beginning of the seventh month, but it was also, trumpets were blown at the beginning of every month. And why were trumpets blown at the beginning of every month? Well, for one very simple reason, because they didn't have calendars hanging on their walls. What day is this? Yeah, 14th. When did the first happen? We have our Julian calendar. And our Julian calendar has 12 months in the year and so on. The Hebrew calendar, you all know, is a lunar calendar. And the first of the month was when the new moon appeared. But who knows when the new moon appears? Maybe it's a cloudy night. And maybe everybody doesn't get together on the new moon. Well, after all, you know, if you pay your taxes one day late, well, there's a penalty. Unless it's post-stamped that day, anyhow. So if they paid their rent, unless it was postage stamped in ancient times, on that day, well, they needed to know. People needed to know when the month began. And if there was a blowing of the trumpets, why, at Jerusalem, why, then they would blow the trumpets also in Bethlehem, and it would spread to Gibeon and on to Ramallah and all these other places and all over the country. There would be trumpets blown to signify it was, you start a new calendar now, new month. So the blowing of trumpets had a very practical significance. And to have the Feast of Trumpets at the beginning of the seventh month was particularly practical. So they would all have the Day of Atonement on the same day. And so they would have the day of the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Ingathering, Sukkot, that it would begin on the same day. So the High Holy Days, as the Jews call them now, were the fall festivals, and they included the bringing in of the harvest and the consequent sacrifices and so on. So that's detailed there. Now, it is also found in other parts of the Bible. A good bit of Leviticus, of course, is found in other places, particularly in Deuteronomy, some also in Numbers. This particular item of the five feasts, three of them at least, are found twice in Leviticus, once in Numbers and once in Deuteronomy. Why in so many places? Well, first of all, they were significant, but the different places usually have a different emphasis. What offerings you bring, so on. But it is interesting to compare them all. So that is section 23 and 25. 24 has something of the pressed olive oil, but also it has this interlude of what happened when the blasphemer was brought forward and he was stoned to death. That is a law, of course, but it does interrupt somewhat this particular thing. Suppose it interrupted because it happened. That takes us through 25, and then the last 26, the last chapter of the so-called Code of Holiness. The last chapter, 26, the NIV has it headed reward for obedience and then punishment for disobedience. This is a section which says, if you follow my decrees, I will bless you. Observe my Sabbaths. I am the Lord. Do not place a carved stone on your land. I am the Lord your God. This refrain comes out, and therefore this chapter is included in the so-called Code of Holiness. But this chapter is very much like the chapters at the end of Deuteronomy. The end of Deuteronomy, where you have everybody is warned. If you obey, then it will be fine. If you disobey, cursed you will be in this and cursed you will be in that. And you will be in a foreign land and exile. But if from there you turn and repent. This passage in Deuteronomy is somewhat parallel to the passage in Leviticus. For that reason, we have to consider some, I suppose, the questions that are raised in the Deuteronomy section. And these are the questions of covenant. Is this a covenant? Is it a covenant formulation? Well, there's been a great deal of emphasis, you know, in Old Testament studies and in the last 25, 30 years, I guess, on this subject of covenants. And maybe I'll say it again, this emphasis on covenants partly comes out of what I have on the board. The case laws here, the case laws are not unusual in ancient times. The Code of Hammurabi, which you should read parts of sometime, the Code of Hammurabi has several hundred, 300 or so, case laws. If a citizen does such and such, the penalty is so and so. If a slave does such and such, the penalty is so and so. And if he does something else, well, the penalty is such and such. So the case laws, that formulation is common in antiquity. But the apodictic laws are not common in antiquity. And you see, these laws were said to come from some Palestinian source. But these moral imperative laws were said to come from some nomadic wilderness source. But you see, the idea is to find some source back of it. Of course, we haven't considered the idea that the main source was God. But at least in form, this form was not much found. I mean, you can't turn up some Egyptian Ten Commandments exactly. Well, some say there are similarities. And there are similarities. You stop to think about that. There are similarities for the Ten Commandments. You don't have to be a Christian to know that it is wrong to kill. You don't have to be a Hebrew in order to know that it is wrong to steal. These are, you might say, common law. Conscience tells you that much. Now, of course, the Ten Commandments include also religious law, where conscience doesn't tell you, you shall not bow down to graven images. At least if conscience tells you that, there's an awful lot of people in the world that have violated their conscience. And of course, they have. But the idea of the first four commandments, our duty to God, that is not found among the surrounding countries. But these last commandments, the last six commandments, are duty to man, they can be paralleled because everybody knows this. But they do not appear in that form. And so they were looking hard to find a place where the apodictic law was formulated in antiquity. And they came up with Hittite covenants. And this is part of the reason for the emphasis on covenants in Old Testament theology in fairly recent days. Now, whether we should follow that, the Hittite covenants, and of course Hittites were not the only ones that had covenants, but they were vassal treaties. These vassal treaties, the senior, the king overall, would make a covenant with the vassal, the underlord. And he would say, that I am the great king, and I have done so much for you, and you are my vassal, and I tell you that you must not do this, and you must not do that, and if somebody escapes from my land into your land, you shall turn him back for justice, extradition. And at the end, why, they witness before the gods, they have these nine gods or whatever that they have for witness. And so this treaty formulation has been much emphasized. And this is said to be that kind, you see, of a treaty formula. Well, I'm not too impressed myself. You have to look pretty hard to find the treaty formula in some of these things. And indeed, the treaty formula varies from time to time. There are five major things that appear in these treaties. But some treaties don't have all five. And some treaties have a few, one or two extras, you know. The more irregularities you have, why, the less attractive the theory is. But there have been Orthodox people who have insisted that Deuteronomy is such a treaty. And it is like the treaties of the Hittites. Now, the value of that, of course, is that they're early. They have early parallels. And so Meredith Klein, who used to teach at Westminster, I think he's Westminster West or retired now. Meredith Klein wrote a book called Deuteronomy, The Treaty of the Great King. And his argument is that Deuteronomy is early and it is found parallel in the middle of the second millennium. Now, of course, critics didn't like that very well. And they tried to answer, no, there are other treaties in the second millennium, in the first millennium, that would be parallel, and that Klein has not proved his case. Kitchen, who is an outstanding man, a Bible-believing scholar in England, professor of Egyptology at Liverpool, I think, Kitchen answered supporting Meredith Klein. So the argument goes back and forth. And, of course, I believe that these things are second millennium, that these are of the days of Moses, and that they come from Moses. Whether we need to emphasize the treaty formula quite so much, I'm not sure. The similarities are not exact. They may be significant. I feel that those who answer Klein and Kitchen and others, I think that they are false. But whether Kitchen and Klein can prove from this alone that these were second millennium, I'm not so sure. The form question is what bothers me, whether we lay too much emphasis upon it, because these forms vary, and you can expect them to vary. I'm not sure that Moses was a student of Hittite treaty covenants. On the other hand, Moses may well have known them, because Moses was in government, remember, in Egypt. And Egypt did have relationships to the Hittites. Actually, they had their main relationship to the Hittites a little bit after Moses, around 1250, Ramses II, his great treaty with the Hittites. But at least that's one of the things that comes up in the discussion of chapter 26. Although it is part of the Holiness Code, it has in it a section that is very much like the so-called covenant sections of the book of Deuteronomy. And we leave it at that point. Then there's this last chapter, the last chapter on vows. Vows of various kinds. Some vows that are just gifts to the temple. You vow so much, or you vow so many animals. On the other hand, the vows, there are some captives who are vowed. We'll go into details on that. I wonder if we ought not to shut some of the windows. The noise is really pretty heavy. So here's a little bit of a survey of the book of Leviticus, just to refresh ourselves. I have down there that I think that I should ask you all to read the book of Leviticus for this course. I've read the book of Leviticus, I'm sure, but read it for this course and read it with some care as to what the outline of it might be. You make up your own outline of Leviticus and see how it agrees with mine. Are there any questions? Is there one? This just preliminary. Now, this is an overview of the book. I want to look at Leviticus from the viewpoint of orthodoxy first, and then we want to consider also the higher critical questions. With regard to the higher critical questions, let me say this down a piece on point 2b. I refer to Martin Note. Martin Note, an English German scholar, of course, who has been of considerable significance in critical circles. Martin Note had a book called Überlieferungsgeschichte des Pentateuchs, the tradition history of the Pentateuch. And in that he had a section on what he called the D work, the Deuteronomist. And he had another section on what he called the P work, which would include Leviticus. Now, the Deuteronomist, the catch is that for Note, the Deuteronomist includes Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. All that is the work of the Deuteronomist, according to Martin Note. The old criticism, of course, stuck with the Pentateuch, or at least the Hexateuch. So Martin Note has this in his book. Now that book, the first part, was translated into English and prelude by preface by Bernard Anderson. The last part was translated into English later, and it is called The Chronicler's History. Now you see, if you have the Deuteronomist going from Deuteronomy to the end of Kings, the P work, which he called it, The Chronicler's History, goes from the P document through the Book of Chronicles. So he traces this history through. Now, of course, back of that is the idea that the P document is late, and there are a lot of critics held that, but the P document and the chronicler, to the union there, is something that Note has emphasized. And I mention that because that book has been translated, and here it is, The Chronicler's History. I ordered a copy for the library. It's not entered yet, but I ordered a copy for the library, and I have this copy for myself. I have the book in German and struggled through it. Martin Note is not particularly easy German, I found, but I'm very happy to have it in English. It's worth it to have it in English. So I say that because I think the bookstore has two or three extra copies of this, if anybody wants them. I didn't order any for the class, and I don't require you to get them. It's not a text, but it is an interesting book to have, and I mention it at this time. It's expensive, $18 or something. So all German books are expensive. I don't know why. Well, they get expensive in this country, too, for that matter. So to come back to Leviticus in its position as we look at it from the Orthodox point of view, Leviticus is not a book by itself. It's part of the Pentateuch. We might ask why there are five books in the Pentateuch. And I don't know that we know. I'm not sure that Moses thought of them as five books. But they have been called five books for a long time. Of course, the word comes from the Greek, the Penta, five. It is quite likely that there were five books because it was too long to put on one scroll. In ancient times, of course, the writing was different kinds. The early writing comes from around 3000 BC, and there are cuneiform texts from around 3000 BC, maybe just a little earlier. And this was pictographic writing. It's curious, the first writing that we have for a couple hundred years are these tablets with pictographic writing on them, and we can read them. But we don't know for sure what language it is. You can imagine that if I draw a series of pictures on the board. I guess I better not use that illustration because you would know. But if an artist drew some pictures on the board, you could read it. A dog chasing a cat, you know what it is from the picture. But you don't know. You could read it in German, you could read it in English, you could read it in Chinese. So these pictographs. However, it seems pretty clear that this pictographic writing was Sumerian because shortly we find places where it has to be Sumerian. The curious thing, I can't give you the reference, but I'm sure they could be found. The curious thing is that the word that in the pictograph, you have a picture of an arrow. Not exactly like that, but a picture of an arrow, and it seems to stand for life. But why should an arrow stand for life? Apparently, because in Sumerian, it is till and he. It sounds like life. But you see, that means. Author is Sumerian. Doesn't sound like life in English. Arab doesn't sound like life in German, nor in Hebrew, nor in Akkadian, but it does in Sumerian. So, because of things like this, it soon becomes obvious that the early writing, pictographic writing in play, was Sumerian. Well, the writing continued, and they did it on clay. Now, clay was a very practical thing. They had lots of it. And they put in the familiar three-cornered cuneiform marks that developed into a syllabary, as we call it, syllables. And it was used all through Mesopotamia, as you know. You've seen all kinds of clay tablets. Well, I'd hate to try to write the Pentateuch on a clay tablet, right? They had series of clay tablets. The seven tablets of creation of Babylon was a series of clay tablets. I don't think they were bound together as far as I know. If you pick up these clay tablets, how do you know which one to pick up first? Well, they had a principle. They would have a clay tablet with these lines like this, and then at the bottom they would have a particular line, and the next clay tablet, lines like this, would have this same line at the top, which you call a catch line. You go from one to the other, and you're directed from one to the other because of the catch line. So they could have long items on clay tablets, but of course they couldn't have on one clay tablet. Well, the clay tablets have been very useful for us because they're more or less indestructible, especially if the building they were in burned down, which was very common. They were well baked, and they're just like rock, more or less. So the clay tablets give us a lot of writing from ancient Mesopotamia. Now, in Egypt, they didn't write like that. In Egypt, they wrote with a brush. And in Egypt, they used a papyrus. They used it from very early times. Papyrus reed, you know, they cut pieces out of it, and then they laid these strips, laid them down, and then they laid them crosswise. And there was enough glue in the plant. When it was wet, they would press them together, and first thing you know, you had a nice page or a nice piece of paper. Call it paper, papyrus. And that's what they used for their hieroglyphics. Now, for them, it was convenient to use this in a long roll. You could just keep on making it, you know. And so in Egypt, they used the scroll. Many examples of these scrolls, some of them are quite long. The longest scroll on record, as I understand, is the Harris Papyrus. It was not written by an ancestor of mine. I think it was a Britisher who had some money that has not continued in the family. And so he bought this thing, and it's in the British Museum. But I think it's something like 30 feet long. I forget, didn't look it up. But it's a long one. And so this was the a scroll. Now, of course, even a long scroll, 30 feet. The Isaiah scroll, a good long scroll, too. But to have a scroll with a whole Pentateuch on it would be a long scroll. I figured it out. Depends, of course, on how big you write, I guess. But it's probable that a scroll of the entire Pentateuch was, if not impossible, at least not practical. And of course, remember also, you have to refer to it. You have to find out how many burnt offerings you have on a particular feast day. You have to look it up. And if you look it up, well, you have to begin at Genesis 1, roll till you find it, you know. So it's much more convenient to have smaller scrolls. So it is quite probable that the reason for the Pentateuch being divided in five points like this was a practical reason. Whether it was done in Moses' day or whether it was done by succeeding scribes, I guess we don't know or need to know. But at least it was that Now, of course, there's a practical reason, there's a practical angle for this. The Jews, by the days of Moses, would have written neither cuneiform nor hieroglyphs. The Jews had an alphabet. Now, that alphabet was invented somewhere around 1700 B.C. And the origin of the alphabet is not entirely certain. There are different theories. The theory that I think is most attractive is what's called the acrophonic principle. That is, you would draw a picture of a creature. Well, here's a creature. We'll make up an alphabet. This, when I see that picture, I say, okay. You never know why. Here. When I see that picture, I say, duh. Duh. Get it? Of course, it's English. I picked up English alphabet now. But the Hebrews did that sort of thing. Only they had better pictures. They took a picture, for instance, of an ox. This is an old deal in ancient. Let's see whether I think it's old. This is, they didn't put the eyes in, but this is a picture of an ox head on. This is used in the pictographic language, used in the early days, even before the alphabet and before writing. It's used in pottery decoration. Rubranium, it's called. The picture of an ox head on. So, of course, it can be simplified. Very soon, you simplify these things. Used the two. It was all through that. There are scratches. The date of them is not entirely certain, but there are scratches on the rocks near the mines in Sinai. The Sinaitic alphabetic inscriptions. And they are very brief. They're just scratches, graffiti, I guess you would call them. But some of them can be read. And their date is uncertain. But at least the writing was available. Now, this writing was not on, really it was in the Egyptian territory where there was papyrus, you see, available. So this writing also was with a brush and not with wedge on clay. And that's why we don't have much ancient Hebrew. See, in Mesopotamia, we've got scads of stuff. I remember and I was studying under Dr. Oppenheim, and he was talking about the writing of ancient times, and Sumerians and all. He said there must be a million tablets in different museums of the world. He looked up and he says, those fellows were writing like crazy. And they were in Egypt, and they were in Palestine. In Mesopotamia, the writing has been preserved. In Egypt, the writing has been preserved because the papyri there are buried in tombs where it never rains, where it is as dry as a bone. A dry bone. Actually, when they were excavating, when they were building the Aswan Dam, you know, south of the Aswan Dam, there was going to be a big lake. The archaeologists tried to find everything they could before it got covered with the water, you know. And they excavated some early graves, and I remember seeing at the time that it was around 5,000 B.C. And here was a grave of a person who was so well preserved that you could see tattoo marks on the person's skin. And the comment was made that the ground was so dry that there were no worms. And so they just didn't decompose. But in Palestine, if you write on papyrus is a vegetable after all. And every winter in Palestine, you have a rainy season. And the rainy season, the things begin to rot, mildew, whatnot. And so the writing that they had in Palestine also was considerable, but we don't have it. What we do have is a few scraps later, but we have them from the Dead Sea area. They were on skin, and these are the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Dead Sea Scrolls have been fairly well preserved because it's so dry down by the Dead Sea. Not totally dry, but pretty much by the Dead Sea. But they had their writing, their scribes, and a lot of it. So there was writing in Palestine. We don't need to assume there was a time, you know, before archaeology came forward. There was a time back in the 1800s when critical scholars said that Moses couldn't write. Well, it's strange to think that Moses couldn't write. If he was an educated man, which he surely was, he could write three languages. And he probably could. But nobody says that anymore. Oh, they were writing in great shape. But probably the Pentateuch was written out in various books because it was too long to go on one scroll, whether the scroll was made of skin or papyrus. Well, I've gone over. It's 5 after. So take a breather anyhow. Stand up. Stretch.